Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
Today's program was brought to you by Whole Foods Market. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
Some folks like to get away, take a holiday from the neighborhood. Hop a flight to Miami Beach or to Hollywood. But I'm taking a Greyhound on the Hudson River line. I'm in a New York state of mind. Stars in their fancy cars and their limousines. Been high in the Rockies, under the evergreens. I know what I'm needing, and I don't want to waste more time. I'm in a New York state of mind.
Yes, indeed. It's a number one A superlative day in New York. Yes, we are burning down the house. I'm Curtis B. Wayne, coming to you live from Brooklyn, where the weather is just as fabulous as it is in Manhattan today. And this kind of day is a good day to stroll through the city and enjoy it. And so this weather was making me feel wistful and meditative and remembering that it wasn't always preordained that the variety of the built environment that we enjoy in New York City, in all the boroughs, would have turned out to be this delightful mixture of buildings of different ages and different scales with so much happening at the street level. We owe so much to the efforts of Jane Jacobs. You may not have heard of her. She was an architectural writer. Starting in 1952, she was writing for Architectural Forum, which was a very tony, shall we say, high-toned architectural journal that unfortunately is no longer with us. She started writing and thinking about what made the city so delightful. She was born and grew up in Scranton, Pennsylvania, but moved as a young adult to the West Village. And she was successful in resisting this post-war trend of thinking that was sponsored in part by people as powerful as the Rockefeller family. David Rockefeller and Nelson, both of whom took a keen interest in the cities. And there was this notion that old neighborhoods with old buildings that were run down should be knocked down and replaced by brand new projects, housing projects. Yes, if you go to Harlem, you'll see housing projects. If you go to the Lower East Side, you will see these housing projects. They owe a lot to the thinking and writing of Corbusier. We talked about that a little bit previously. The Ville Radieuse, the radiant city, the tower in the park. Even Old Man Wright had a fling with the idea of a tower in a farm in his Usonian days. But so these men of wealth wanted to wipe out neighborhoods and replace them with clean, hygienic towers. And they wanted very much to bring in more and more roadways. And the prince of this movement, the unelected power broker, was Robert Moses. You may know a little bit about him. From about 1933, he was Parks Commissioner in New York City. And as Parks Commissioner, he had control over a lot of green space in New York. And he paved over a lot of green space. And when in the late 1950s, early 1960s, his big plan was to connect the FDR Drive, the Franklin Delano Roosevelt Drive on the east side of Manhattan, with the West Side Highway by means of a crosstown throughway, would run straight through the village. And of course, where you have a high-speed highway, you have to have cloverleafs and ramps and such. And the ideal place to park that, of course, would have been Washington Square Park, because you have Fifth Avenue coming down, and then the extension of Fifth Avenue on the other side of the park is LaGuardia Place. So you've got surface transportation routes that would connect Canal Street. You know, at one end of Canal Street, there's a bridge. At the other end of Canal Street, there's the Holland Tunnel. And even though Robert Moses himself never had a driver's license, never learned how to drive, he was the major force behind the transformation of our built environment by means of the parkways. Because he was a parks commissioner, he had pull when it came to creating new so-called parks. You know, the Northern Ireland parkway in Long Island, and the Southern and the Meadowbrook, all of these parkways, and then up in Westchester, the Bronx River Parkway. These were conceived of as parks, as linear parks that you would enjoy while motoring. And of course, when there are highways, they fill with cars. And the whole movement of people out of, say, the Bronx, first to Co-op City, all of the grand buildings on the Grand Concourse in the Bronx, which are just slowly now being restored and people with income are moving back. That was a very posh address, and people moved en masse to Co-op City. Now, of course, once you're in Co-op City, you can't get anywhere unless you have a car. So this whole network of superhighways connecting the boroughs of New York were the work of Robert Moses. And we'll talk about him a little bit further in future episodes. Especially, you know, keep in touch, listeners. On June 17th, we're going to speak with James Howard Kunstler, who is a huge foe and outspoken cranky guy of my ilk. I'm sure we'll have a lot in common to talk about. A great critic of the suburban experience, how it is played out. But in any case, when Robert Moses wanted to extend Fifth Avenue right through Washington Square Park and have a cloverleaf there, families who lived around the park were really unhappy, because there were families all around the park, including and mothers and notable people. Now, Moses had a pretty good track record in getting whatever he wanted. The city pretty much handed over vast areas of real estate by declaring them slums, handing over the development rights to people who were friends of Moses, who sometimes redeveloped them with high-density, mid- and high-rise housing projects, and sometimes not. But the whole Cross Bronx Expressway, if you've ever driven through the Bronx on I-95, through that slot that cuts through the Bronx, well, that wiped out East Tremont. And it left the people on either side of that vast, stinking trench with cars and trucks isolated from each other, consequently causing people to just simply move away, which led to the decay of the South Bronx, which turned into something resembling Beirut after the Lebanese Civil War. I mean, it was scary for a very long time. And it's still not quite back to where it was. Anyhow, Moses was responsible for all sorts of fabulous things. I mean, he was involved in both World's Fairs here in New York, the 39 and the 64-65. He was responsible for the development of the first Shea Stadium in Flushing Meadow Park. Again, buildings in parklands. But he was this huge proponent of the automobile, this wave of modernity had few detractors. It was sold to the American public, starting with General Eisenhower, then President Eisenhower, who had observed the usefulness of the Autobahns in Germany for moving troops. And, you know, the Cold War sentiment here in the United States, well, it was very tense, and there was huge, huge fear of the Russians and of domestic communists. And so anyone who spoke against the prevailing attitudes was suspect. And there was this very dark period of McCarthyism. And I don't want to talk too much about politics, but anyone who opposed this grand idea that superhighways, Autobahn-style highways, were necessary for the movement of troops or for the possible evacuation of people from cities should, I don't know, the Russians arrived and started aerial bombing of New York City, that we'd need to evacuate the boroughs. I mean, this is nonsense. We're a long way from Russia. But there was this huge fear, not only of long-range bombers, but of the atom bomb. And so superhighways were sold to the American public as a national defense initiative. And once there are highways, then, and this is well documented, well understood, the cooperation between the Federal Highway Administration and General Motors and the tire companies and the big three automakers, not just General Motors, but especially General Motors, arranged for the decline of mass transit and the decline of the railroad system. So now we have, to tie this into a little discussion that has everything to do with Heritage Radio Network and the locavore movement, we had then the capability for factory farming thousands of miles away, serving the food needs of large cities like New York. You know, it wasn't that long ago that food came to New York by being loaded off of trains in Hoboken and freight cars put on flat ferries, brought across, put onto rails on the west side of Manhattan and distributed. The High Line, everybody's favorite new park, was part of a system to distribute food up and down between warehouses for Manhattan's food source. Well, that all went away once the interstate highway system really got going by the early 1960s. I think the interstate highway system was officially declared complete only in 1972, but there were effective stretches of it in the late 1950s. So the whole world of Robert Moses and this interstate highway system and the need for more and more cars. Well, the first blow against Robert Moses came when, as Parks Commissioner, despite protests by families who lived near Central Park, authorized and organized the paving of a beautiful wooded glen for the purpose of creating a paved parking lot for Tavern on the Green. Oh, yes, something like 6 in the morning, and this was in 1950, 1953, I think, in the 1950s anyway, bulldozers and men from the Parks Department appeared and started knocking down trees and sawing them up. And it was a huge, huge issue in the press. And there were photos of families weeping and big, tough New York cops standing facing away from this scene of destruction with shame in their faces. And it was all hushed up in the name of progress. But when it came to putting a clover leaf in the middle of the village and decimating Washington Square Park, well, enough was enough. There were enough people of social standing, including Eleanor Roosevelt, the widow of FDR. You know, Eleanor grew up in New York City. She's a native New Yorker. She lived near Gramercy Park, my old neighborhood. She was against it. There were mothers who were not afraid to be against it. Perhaps their husbands didn't want to sign petitions because McCarthyism was still very much in the air. And if you were against progress, then you were some kind of pinko. But because of the social makeup of America of that time, mothers could protest. And when Moses came to speak his bit at Washington Square Park about why this was a good idea, he scoffed, "There's no one here to protest except a bunch of mothers." And he stomped off. Well, one of those mothers was Jane Jacobs. And she wrote about this. And she protested. And she's very important in changing the attitudes. And she was a great proponent of having a variety of different ages and values of buildings. And as she points out, in a really great article that's been reissued, and I'll try to find it so that Jack can post it on this page. There's a link to it. She speaks of why neighborhoods that are great to be in are so, and one of the things that she talks about is that older buildings are ideal for businesses that don't make so much money that they can afford a brand new lease space. You know, if you look at the kinds of chains that are in more modern buildings or newer buildings, you'll see dozens of Strawberries around. And no offense to them, but you'll see Modell's, which is now a really big chain. It started as a small sporting goods store, but now they're everywhere. Or Gap stores, or Urban Outfitters. But you don't see the booksellers anymore. Fourth Avenue, that's that stretch of would-be Park Avenue. Actually, Park Avenue used to be called Fourth Avenue, between Union Square and Astor Place. All along Fourth Avenue, there were bookshops. It was called Booksellers Row. And you could find all kinds of used books that were just fantastic. The only remnant of that really is the Strand, which is a block or so over on Broadway. So Jane Jacobs is seminal and vital and important in terms of changing our attitudes about just wiping out old neighborhoods, calling them slums, and wiping them out just simply for the sake of something that ultimately gives friends of friends the opportunity to make a lot of money in real estate development. Now, look, my bread and butter is working for real estate developers, and I count many real estate developers, if not as friends, but certainly as good people. But I'm not in favor of the kind of faceless stuff that we have to live with. I mean, if you walk around Midtown Manhattan with these tall, international-style office buildings, they're kind of dead at the street level. And what makes New York great is what happens at the pedestrian level. And the fewer cars there are, as Jeanette Sadiq Khan, our current Department of Transportation Commissioner, has discerned in her transformation of Broadway into many blocks of a pedestrian space. Fewer cars is not necessarily a bad thing. It might be a very good thing. Those of you who are cyclists, I know you're in this camp. But in the second part, I want to talk about this notion of wiping out the old just simply because it's old. And it seems that the current nomenclature for something that you want to wipe out is brutalism. And we've spoken about brutalism in previous episodes. We've spoken about the need to preserve some of the modern movement artifacts with Teo Proudhon in episode 100 from Doko Momo. And now there are two theaters that were designed by the very intriguing modern architect John Johansson that are surely going to be wiped out. Let me speak a little about Johansson, and then we'll take a break. But Johansson was a Harvard Design School student. You know, when Walter Gropius left Germany because it just politically became too toxic for him, and the Nazis really wanted the Bauhaus closed, and eventually they did. Grop came to the United States, and he was installed as the head of the design school at Harvard. After a few years of that, he was so bored out of his mind with having ordinary students, because he'd had the cream of the crop. He'd had the superstars of design at the Bauhaus, that he started something called the master's class. And in his first master's class were some people who became really prominent in the 50s and 60s and even unto our current time. And in that first master's class was John Johansson and Elliot Noyes and Philip Johnson. And after that period at Harvard, these men went into practice as architects, and they congregated out in the country in New Canaan. They became known as the New Canaan Five, and they built modern houses. John Johansson was the next-door neighbor to Philip Johnson for a while, and Elliot Noyes built his house for his family out there. And a lot of these houses have been lost because they are old, and they're not big like the McMansions that builders still continue to want to build and that people, for some reason, continue to want to buy. So John Johansson may not be known to many of you, but he is an important character. And I have to say, my working week is a little busy, and I've been a little too lame. I know that Johansson is still alive. He's in his late 90s. He lives up, I believe, in Cape Cod, and I will attempt to get a phone number for him so we can talk live sometime in the near future while he's still with us. But this is the end of my little lecture about Jane Jacobs. We'll talk more about her, but let's have a few minutes of the Velvet Underground in her honor. Thank you.
happy, waiting there for him to come home. Waiting down on and on the corner, thinking ways to get back home. Sweet Jane, sweet Jane, oh sweet, sweet Jane. Anyone who ever had a dream, anyone who's ever played a part, anyone who's gonna live lonely, anyone who's ever stood apart.
Oh, yeah. Without Jane Jacobs, there would be no Velvet Underground. There would have been no Warhol Factory. You all know that Warhol was key in the founding of the Velvet Underground, right? The way I understand it is Andy thought it would be cool to have a rock band. It's kind of like Patrick Martin's deciding it would be kind of cool to have a radio station. We love our patrons. Thank you. John Johansson, modern architect. Really cool modern architect. We're going to play a few clips of him speaking. First up, he's going to speak about his notions of architectural organization. So if you could roll that track three, please.
And I was very much tied up into that experimentation. I looked for new organizing ideas. What I found then, of course, was the electronic age. What I did take then from the electronic organization of electronic assemblies was to examine what the elements were. I found there was always a chassis or a base upon which the components were plugged in, and plugged into the components were subcomponents, which more exactly defined what those functions were. You could take those out and put others in, and that was the way the building was built, so you could detach and reattach what you wanted to do. Electronic connections, or the raceways, or the wiring, which is another element, represented circulation and distribution of the services. So they were then taken and adopted, whereby three theaters were the three components, the toilets, the lobbies, the other serving elements that served those were plugged in the side. The connections, though, the wiring system, were five. One, the circuiting system of corridors in the basement where the theater actors and so emanated from. One on the level, which allowed people to come from the gardens, which were all around this, walk between these parts of the building but not enter to interfere with the performances themselves. Then there was the automobile cycle that went around here underneath these ramps and see. And then there's the pathway of the theater goers who come in this way and up through tubes this way into lobbies which were glassed in. The final one was at the top, which was a tower for and distribution of systems there for supplying chilled water for three different air conditioning systems, which had to be separate because they would vibrate and otherwise disturb the performance. It's one of the first anti-compositional. That's a very wonderful thing. It wasn't a matter of good taste. If you walk through this thing, it is chaos. I wanted that. If you want to know how it came, then you trace any of these things back to the center from which the organization is explained. Now, that's rather new thinking. There are certain ways through, but you can't be certain that you'll get through. Chaotic, wonderful. And finding their way, in which process they become part of the process. And the process, you see, is what we're talking about. Not form only, but process. Process of growing, changing, and all that. To be part of the process, then, is to assume or affect the idea that the theater goer is part of the process and becomes a player in the glory of the whole.
Yeah. Apropos of last week, you notice that Johansson doesn't get into archy speak. He doesn't say the phenomenological genesis of the morphological need or any such bullshit. He talks plainly about his design intentions. Now, the building that he's describing there, this is for you, my young student listeners or recent graduates. He's talking about the Mummers Theater, which is pretty amazing organization of boxes up in the air in Oklahoma City. Now, that was damaged in a flood, and a couple of organizations are fighting over who owns it, and it's going to take a lot of money to fix it up, and it will probably be demolished. Now, the other theater of his, and I refer you to an article written by Amanda Colson Hurley, who's been our guest here, in Architect Magazine. You can look that up at architectmagazine.com. Posted May 16th. She's written about a brutalist theater that Johansson designed, the Morris Mechanic Theater in downtown Baltimore. And it is brutalist. It's got concrete, and the concrete is exposed. But when I look at it, it's very fresh. Yeah, it's small. But there is a place for small theaters, but it's been purchased. And here you go again. City planners are on the loose. Here, the Baltimore's Downtown Partnership, an economic development group, backs tearing down the structure. Jack, let's skip track 4, which was just a musical break. I'm kind of on a roll. Let's listen to track 5, where Johansson expounds a little bit.
Some critics said it's like a bubble diagram brought to life. Bubblegram, if you don't know what that is, that's what an architect does. He takes the major functions of the program, puts them here, connects them, and gives them the general relationship one to the other, the disposition of all these things. So I went directly to that and built it, and that's what it is. It was a totally new design vocabulary, unknown to the profession. It was a shock. Then they found that a new lovely public park was being made, and this would be in the centerpiece of that park. Now that's a gift to any architect. I was free. It was a free building, you see, and not leaned up against others. So that somewhat explains it, and I had all this time, I took this time to change my vocabulary from new brutalism, which was all concrete, as heavy as you could probably make it, which was popular at the time, to the introduction of light sheet metal, brightly colored siding. You get out of a catalog. Color, I didn't care. All color is good. Very low cost things. Silos and sheds of this sort were all over Oklahoma and other states of our union. So that is another thing I'm pleased about. They were what we call ad hocism, is what I was taken by, defined as the impulse of taking this and that, anything that is available, serviceable, and inexpensive, and throwing them together to make something. So ad hocism, the variation of meaning, wonderful. Slang, some critic wrote an article on me in a magazine called The New Slang. The best of our language derives from slang. The worst of it is discarded. So architecture is a language and should have its own derivations and own slang, discarding the worst and elevating the best of it to acceptable, if not noble, position. I knew I was onto something when I...
Yeah, that was fascinating. He goes on, but we don't need to listen to all of that. He describes very candidly here his affection for color. If you think we're broke now, economy-wise, my younger friends, this is nothing. We were really broke in the 70s. There just was no money for construction. And this ad hocism of which he's speaking was a way to get buildings built. And it was a natural response to the economy. So when you look at these buildings, you have to understand the time in which they were designed and built. And it made perfect sense. And actually, it was fun. And the use of color, as a young student, was very exciting to me. Those of you who are able to listen to this before tomorrow, May 21st, please go to the Cooper Union end of year show. It's open to the public starting at 6 o'clock at Cooper Union's Foundation Building. That's 7th Street at 3rd Avenue. And you'll see all sorts of things that students are thinking of. One of the aspects of the current teaching of architecture that disturbs me so is the suppression of color in student work. All this gray and black and white in the drawings. In my time, we were allowed to use color if we had a reason to use color. Color could be used in a biomimetic sort of way, that is to say, something that was referential to a landscape element, but that might in fact not be landscaped. That was okay. My own thesis project had color, but it had color that was biomimetic. Of course, we didn't have the word biomimetic then. This was referring to as if it were, in the case of my project, a meadow attached to a building. It didn't occur to me that we would actually plant things on horizontal surfaces the way that we now are doing with green roofs. But, you know, we learn. Things do develop and improve. And going back to the previous cut where he's talking about getting ideas about architectural form by looking at how, and of course his point of view was electronic circuits of the early 20th century. If you ever looked inside an old tube amplifier or tube amplified radio, you'll see all sorts of things and wires and resistors and capacitors and tubes and transformers and coils of different kinds that do different things. And that, you know, until actually I had listened to that track, I didn't understand where he got a lot of that idea stream. Of course, he also talked about silos and the Oklahoma Midwestern landscape, which has been always of interest to many different people, not only Americans, but also Corbeau. To get back to him again, you know, he was mad about grain silos for their sculptural strength. And it's hard to fault him for that. There is a lot to that. And I think Johansson is a great example of how we as architects benefit from being, in a way, generalists, but absolutely being cognizant of technology. His architecture is everything about the technological artifact that's arranged in an architectural expression. There's one last cut. We have track 6. He talks about technology a little bit. Let's listen to that.
There'll be no factories. There'll be no labor. And manufacturing will be achieved by selecting atoms, molecules, putting them in a vat in the presence of a computerized code created by ourselves, which would be analogous to DNA in nature. Out of that, then, everything will grow. Automobiles, marine engines, everything that we need, including buildings and cities. So as an architect, I rush in there and say, well, what I can do is to understand from these physicists what they think is will be possible. One of those things is morphability, meaning that you can have built for yourself something of a particular form, but afterward that form can change and then go back to itself, move this way and back, or change and hold itself, or decompose itself and revert to the original molecules that it was originated, used for recycling. Hard to believe.
He's talking about 3D printing. He's talking about the cradle-to-grave approach that's been promoted by Bill McDonough, who was one of the first self-acknowledged green architects. And we've talked about 3D printing here on Burning Down the House a few times. And those of you who grew up with the personal computer, for you, 3D printing is like da bomb. It's like the thing. It's the coming thing. And there's Johansson speaking just a couple years ago, not so very long ago. You can tell it by the age in his voice, that he sees great future for architecture in terms of reusable components and growing growing houses using the basic stuff. Now, that's probably well beyond my lifetime, although I intend to be around quite some time, so you're not going to have the benefit of me shutting up anytime soon. But it gives us a lot to think about. And we will get back to speaking about Jane Jacobs, and we will always strive to leave us our conversations on a more positive note. I've gotten some feedback recently, and some of you think I'm perhaps a little too negative. And it is such a nice day, but it's important to understand that all of these things... well, there's this great line from an old movie that I remember, that us humans on this big, beautiful planet, or as Bucky Fuller would say, spaceship Earth, we're just fleas arguing over who owns the dog. Thank you for listening. We'll go out with a little Monty Python music. Keep the faith.
Just remember that you're standing on a planet that's evolving and revolving at 900 miles an hour. That's orbiting at 90 miles a second, so it's reckoned a sun that is the source of all our power. The sun and you and me and all the stars that we can see are moving at a million miles.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.